I had my own business before I did venture capital, and I kept the startup going for 4 years. And I look back in retrospect and say, we were kind of done at the end of year one. And the other 3 years were a total waste of my life and just slogging on, trying to make something work that didn't, right? It was a dumb deal. It was a fail, and I should have failed quicker. So I put that out there right at the start, because you know, even if you end up, and you kind of outlined three options. And just to put it out there, even if you end up to the entrepreneur, even if you end up the third option, the thing you're not wasting is time, and you know, time is all you got.
This Week in Startups is brought to you by Northwest Registered Agent. Start your business fast and secure with Northwest Registered Agent. In just 10 clicks and 10 minutes, set up your entire business identity. Name, address, mail service, phone, email, website, and domain. Everything you need to launch your business in minutes. For just $39 plus state fees, Northwest will handle your complete business identity. Visit northwestregisteredagent.com/twist. Wistia, the all-in-one video platform for business, with tools that help you create, manage, and measure the impact of your videos. Try Wistia for free at wistia.com/startups1. And Hidden Layer. Generative AI is revolutionizing industries. Hidden Layer's AI detection and response solution secures your generative AI and LLMs from malicious attack, helping you generate more by enabling seamless and secure generative AI. Visit hiddenlayer.com/twist to learn more.
Welcome to This Week in Startups. I am thrilled to welcome my friend, a colleague, someone I've worked closely with, Rory O'Driscoll. Welcome to This Week in Startups.
Hey, Mark, great to see you. And yes, we've worked closely with, and dare I say it, someone I've lost money with.
Oh, are we going to go straight there?
Well, we can put a pin on it and circle back, but you really get to know the people you lose money with.
That's true, which is probably why we still like talking, because I totally think we lost money together in honor.
In honor.
You've been investing at scale venture partners for 30 years. I kind of thought I'd been doing this a long time. I crossed 17 years as a venture capitalist, 30 years.
That's correct. Yeah. And 30 years on Labor Day at scale or its predecessors.
Amazing.
Same number.
Congratulations. I hope you'll celebrate. That means that you really, 1994 was, yep, I believe, the year that Netscape IPO'd.
No, I IPO'd in 95. It was IPO'd in August 95. But yes, I actually, one of the first things I saw it was in late 93, I saw Netscape and was still Mosaic at the first Internet World Conference. So yes, it was right at the start of the dot-com boom.
Yes, I remember Mosaic and all of that as well. I was a technologist back then. I was a computer programmer, not a venture capitalist. But given that, you have seen the world that existed before really venture capital, and even the internet got crazy. So you've seen a lot of cycles. We're going to talk a lot about that today. But I like to start shows off with advice for founders. And so let's get right into it. If you were a founder and you had raised a little bit of money, let's say $3 million, $10 million, whatever, you had traction, you felt like you had a business going, but it wasn't booming. What would you do? Like, would you try to grow as quickly as possible so you could raise more venture capital? Would you cut your costs and get to whatever they used to call it, ramen profitable or, you know, steady state, but then knowing it's going to be harder to raise venture capital, would you return money? Like, what would you do?
It's a great question. And, you know, when you sent me the questions, I kind of came up with my first degree answer. And then it kind of gnawed at me for an hour. And I've been kind of mulling over kind of nuances on the answer. So maybe start. I had my own business before I did venture capital, and I kept the startup going for 4 years. And I look back in retrospect and say, we were kind of done at the end of year one. And the other 3 years were a total waste of my life and just slogging on, trying to make something work that didn't, right? It was a dumb deal. It was a fail, and I should have failed quicker. So I put that out there right at the start, because you know, even if you end up, and you kind of outlined three options. And just to put it out there, even if you end up to the entrepreneur, even if you end up the third option, the thing you're not wasting is time, and you know, time is all you got. So don't be ashamed if you end up in option three. But stepping back, you face a choice in the first two. Do you go for it, keep the burn high, and stay what I think David Sachs elegantly referred to as venture fundable? In other words, with enough growth rate to be attractive to venture, or do you hunker down and get the cash flow break even or near it and try and survive longer, right? That's the first big question. And the interesting thing is, it's not a continuum. It's a binary divide. Do you reach for the stars and go for that venture growth rate, knowing that by doing that, you intrinsically re-risk the deal? You can't de-risk it. And if you fail, you fall short, right? Or do you hunker down? But it's exactly what you said. If you hunker down, in a lot of businesses, especially enterprise software businesses, where distribution takes capital, once your growth rate slows, it's really hard to attract additional venture money. So it's a very binary decision, especially at the 3 or 10 million capital raise. If you raise 50 or 80 million and you're doing 100 million in revenues, maybe you can throttle down, take your growth rate down, and then come back up because you have an asset that's worth something. But if you're early on in these early stage companies at the 1 million, 2 million level, the truth is, if you slow down at the $2 million level and you're growing at 10%, venture guys aren't going to be interested. So you are making a binary choice, right? So it really boils down to you assessing how likely it is to get that reacceleration.
I don't disagree with anything you said, but I think the first thing you need to do is a gut check. Are you deeply passionate about what you're doing? Do you want to spend the next 5 years of your life on this? As someone once said to me in my first startup, I built a company. It was doing well. We got to 14 million of run rate revenue, 36 million in backlog, but it wasn't looking like it was going to change the world. The biggest problem I had, Rory, is I raised too much money. So I was kind of upside down on the cap table. I had a bunch of investors with big expectations. Now, here's the thing. A mentor said to me, you only have your youth and your energy once. You are painting on too small a canvas. You have honored your fulfillment to your investors. It was 5 years in. You don't owe them anything else. You've given them your best effort. So if you don't want to stay doing this, it's okay now. They will get over it if you tell them that this isn't going to work. Now, I stayed around for another year. I transitioned. I brought in a new CEO and I started my second company. That piece of advice changed my life because my second company got acquired by Salesforce. I made a bit of money that enabled me to pivot into venture capital. So that, like, I would have stayed another 5 years. But I do want to point out the thing that really drove me, Rory, is that I just wasn't loving what I was doing. Now, I want to contrast that with a friend of mine, Adam Miller, who had Cornerstone On Demand. And he and I were like kind of roughly at the same time, roughly at the same level. And he stuck with it and went on to IPO, made a lot more money. Everything worked out because he got through one cycle. Now, the people who did exactly what I did at the company, it was called Build Online in the construction space, the next generation of companies, the best company sold for $800 million. And then fast forward, we now have Procore and other players in the space. So like for me, sometimes the market comes, but it comes later than you expected. But I just wasn't having fun. I'm sorry for the long response to your response.
No, it's cool because the meta point there is it's so multifactorial. It's so fact and circumstance specific, right? That, you know, you can't give generic. It's hard to give generic advice without getting the facts. But what you can give, some of the generic advice, you can't give advice on the decision, but you can give advice on how to make the decision. And I think what your friend said, versions of that are really important, right? Which is you owe your best efforts, but you don't owe us your whole life. We're diversified as venture investors.
The advice is to know that VCs might tell you otherwise, but if you've given it your best, truly given it your best, and you act in honor in how you communicate why you're not going to continue the journey, they'll get over it.
Totally. And, you know, especially if you give them time and help them land the plane or recruit someone else.
Exactly. Do it ethically.
Because I actually, funny enough, I tell people, my CEOs, this a lot. It's kind of a nuance on that, even at later stages. And they're trying to figure out what to do is kind of, because what I say to them is, I want you to be selfish. In other words, it's my job as a board to make sure your incentives are aligned with mine. And if I haven't, I'm an idiot.
Yeah.
And it's your job then to respond on your incentives. So don't spend a whole bunch of time cycling through what do you owe me? What do you owe yourself? Just do what's right for you. And my job is to make sure that I'm aligned with you. And, you know, if the cap table is sensible, if you own a big slug and we all make money together or we all keep going together, that works out, right? But my job is to create the alignment. And then your job becomes simpler as the CEO. Do what feels right for you. It's what you said. Are you feeling it? Do you have passion for it? Do you have any reason for that passion? Or are you just insane? Right? Do you have actual evidence of success? And then another part of it, I'll throw it right out there, is because this is a good one for Vivek. I'm actually dealing with this one time now. Is, remember, if we say to you, we want you to keep going, we want you to soldier on, but we're not prepared to cough up any more money, right? You know, our actions speak a damn sight louder than our words, yeah. Right? And telling some guy to strap himself to the mast for the next 3 years on $2, eat ramen noodles, when he doesn't want to do it just because we want him to do it.
Hey, startups, are you ready to launch your business without the headache? Well, with Northwest Registered Agent, you can set up your entire business identity in one place. Just 10 clicks and 10 minutes, and they'll have your business officially formed and ready to go. They take care of everything, giving you a complete business identity setup, including a business address, phone line, website, hosting, and a free domain, all under one roof. Do you need a trademark? Well, they got you covered with their own law firm, Law on Call. And they offer full services at incredibly affordable rates without the usual runaround. Worried about privacy? Well, rest assured, because everything is covered by Northwest's Privacy by Default, where they handle everything in-house, so your personal data stays protected. Northwest Registered Agent isn't just a service. It's your startup's new best friend. They've created a new category, a true one-stop shop for business formation. And Northwest loves supporting startups and is offering our listeners a $39 complete business formation package. For just $39 plus state fees, Northwest will handle your complete business identity, getting you up and running in no time. Visit northwestregisteredagent.com/twist today.
Here's a good point to interject, Rory, is I agree, of course, with what you're saying. It's okay to have an open dialogue, and hopefully you have an open relationship with your venture capitalist. If you have a venture capitalist you can't have this open relationship and open dialogue with, you probably chose the wrong VC. But I think somehow people don't have the hard discussions to say, look, I want to tell you about how I'm feeling about my business. What's your current outlook? I'm not trying to force you to say, are you going to write another check? But if I'm committed to the next 3 to 5 years, are you? Or are you kind of looking at this like it didn't meet your expectations and you'd be okay if I created a soft landing? Like, it ought to be okay to open up conversations like that with your investors. And because I know a lot of entrepreneurs don't, I'd say almost all entrepreneurs don't open up that conversation. Sometimes I open it up for them.
That's smart. Because the truth is, what I've learned is, if you don't have that conversation, it's not like they're not thinking those thoughts. So people will end up acting on it, and you'll just be like, why is this happening? It's far better off to just know what's going on and have the conversation. Almost invariably, I believe, having an informed conversation is a lot better than, you know, groping in the dark where you're trying to figure out what they're trying to do. And sometimes, you know, that they're trying to optimize for you, but you haven't had a conversation on what you want, or you haven't been clear with them what your expectations are. So I agree. And, you know, it's a tricky conversation because you don't want it to read as, oh, it's all awful. But, you know, you do have to be able to say, you know, how do we feel about where this business is going? Are we creating value? Is this the best use of your time and money?
And the truth is, some VCs, just like some entrepreneurs, but some VCs are not super high on EQ. So maybe not everyone is prepared to have this conversation, but it's a conversation you should at least respectfully try to have. I want to pivot. And sure. I want to pivot to the market. And I want to talk about, you know, here we are in 2024. I mentioned you have a 30-year cycle in investing in the internet. Obviously, the first big wave was everything moving online. For people who didn't live through that, it was both an exciting time because a lot was going online, but like access was incredibly slow. Applications, you couldn't do a lot in the browser. So it was like clunky to get people to use it. Like those were different days. We then had a big wave of things like Ajax, if you remember Ajax, which I think it was asynchronous. Was it JavaScript and something? Or I can't remember anymore. Anyway, it gave you a lot more flexibility in browser. So you could actually make things feel like applications. That was a big wave. Then we had a big wave that came from video streaming. Then we had a big wave, of course, that came from mobile. So AI seems to be this big platform shift, is it? And what is your outlook personally and at Scale Venture Partners about AI in 2024?
Okay, so unpack that a little. That's a good broad history of the internet, mainly to enterprise software. So kind of simplistically put, I would say it's really been 20 years of take X and move it to the cloud, right? You literally look at every application that existed in 99, and over the next 20 years, you move them to the cloud. You started with individual apps, that was SaaS. And then he went on to horizontal compute, and that was AWS and all the PaaS providers. So that was, as you say, the last 20 years, right? You're right. The big question is, we do believe that the next 20 years are going to be about adding intelligence in some way, shape, or form to those applications that are now in the cloud, or maybe sometimes indeed at the edge. So in one sense, it's analogous to that. It's like you can, you at a simplistic level, you can say you spent 20 years investing in moving stuff to the cloud. Now you can spend 20 years adding AI to all the stuff that's in the cloud. So at that level, yes, it's a platform shift, but I think it's going to be very different, right? I don't think one level down, I think the analogy falls apart, right? Okay. Because I think in a way that is kind of mildly angstlick, because the great thing about take X and move it to the cloud, it was simple. We had 20 years of making money where you literally just looked at Salesforce, big insiders, he worked for Oracle, he competed with Siebel, he said, oh, we should make that, but put it in the browser. Big ass insight, you know, execute, do the same thing for
As a guy who worked for Mark Benioff.
I remember that, yeah.
He was a really good technical visionary, and he had some really strong belief systems. I remember building my first company, and everyone wanted me to do client servers. So they wanted me to have the browser-based version of what I did, but they wanted a local version. And they wanted a local version because they wanted more functionality. They wanted the data stored locally. They wanted higher performance. And I watched what Salesforce was doing at the time, and Salesforce just refused to do all of that. And the issue was, like, if you were building software for heterogeneous environments, you then had to have development teams that could manage all the integrations with all this heterogeneous environment. And Mark had great vision to say, I'm just going to build in the browser. The browser is going to get better. The experience is going to get better. My unit economics are going to be better. I'm going to win. I'm the cloud company.
Totally. And that was great about it. It was a single sentence bet. And the sentence was right. He put a little sign that said no software and executed brilliantly, right? And if you look at it, broadly speaking, the thing that they make in 2024 is highly recognizable when you were there in 1999, right? Yep. I don't think it's going to be the same in AI, because what it's doing, instead of moving an existing app from on-prem to a better compute environment of the cloud, this is about reimagining and reinventing what the entire app does. And often it's, instead of kind of monitoring the work, it's actually doing the work, right?
Yeah.
So the first thing is, it's very different than copying something and moving it to a different architecture. It's literally reinventing. So every single application level company in this space is trying to reinvent workflows, not just transform them from one computer architecture to another. So it's way trickier. It's moving extraordinarily quickly, and it's evolving. These companies evolve like fruit flies. I mean, I've done some AI investments in the last 3 or 4 years where I look back 1 year, 2 years in, and a huge amount of what we thought was true 2 years ago just isn't true anymore. And we have smart people. They've adopted. They're doing the next thing. And that, again, is so different than what we went through in, you know, take X, move it to the cloud land, right? It's a very different. So we think it's a thing, but we think...
Does that give some advantage to startups? I mean, like, the big debate that everyone's having, I think, on the investment side is AI favoring the incumbents, where Microsoft, Amazon, Facebook, and the big players have so much dollars to train models, build models, they've got customer information, and therefore life favors them. And then there's the people who say, no, like, this is a fundamental shift and it favors new entrants. Do you have a point of view?
Sure. I think it's going to be that, interestingly enough, I think it's going to be not dissimilar to the way it unfolded in, let's call it SaaS and cloud, which is at the infrastructure level. There's three hyperscalers, Amazon, Google, and Microsoft, in kind of in cloud platform services pre-AI. And there'll be some version of that for foundation models. Will it be 3? Will it be 5? Will it be 7? I don't know, right? It'll be those three guys. It'll be OpenAI. It'll be one or two others, right? And I think at that level, it's going to be really hard very quickly to play as a startup. I mean, arguably it already is. If you haven't already raised $2 billion and you don't have a sovereign wealth fund sugar daddy, it's too late, right? However, just as in kind of SaaS and cloud, at the application level, it's going to be very different, because everyone has their own workflow. Everyone has their own needs. And truly, whatever the foundation model does is only, in all the deals we're looking at, is only a small, not insignificant, but by no means the vast majority of the total process that you're automating. And there's a whole load of industry-specific, you know, fact and circumstance-specific product that you're building around whatever process you're automating. So I think there'll be lots of apps.
Hey, everyone. Quick shout out to my friends at Wistia, the go-to platform for any marketer wanting to make the most out of video. So if you're deeply involved in crafting email campaigns, display ads, or creating that flawless piece of branded content, you need to integrate video into your marketing mix. You know that. Video is super influential right now. Consumers expect it. And Wistia is the ultimate tool every marketer needs to supercharge their video strategy. It's a powerhouse for generating leads. You can also add Wistia's lead gen forms directly inside your videos, like product tutorials or webinars, and start turning viewers into valuable leads. And guess what? Wistia seamlessly integrates with all the tools you're already using, like Marketo, HubSpot, or Pardot. This means all of those fresh leads and their viewing habits feed directly into your marketing automation platform. Now you can score those leads, get them into your nurture flows, and keep them moving through your sales funnel effortlessly. Wistia even lets you add custom CTAs to your videos to drive prospects to the next stage of your funnel. If you're looking to elevate your lead generation, streamline lead nurturing, and enhance user engagement with advanced analytics, Wistia is the perfect tool for you. So here's your call to action. Wistia is everything a marketer needs to create, host, analyze, and market video. Try Wistia for free by heading over to wistia.com/startups1. Again, that's wistia.com/startups1.
I want to throw this out because I'm really interested in real time in your thoughts on this. So, you know, like all of us, we're struggling, like, what is a worthy investment in AI? And of course, AI investments are expensive these days, and everyone's throwing money in and lots of competition, usual dynamics in venture. Yeah. So I met with this young lady yesterday, just a wonderfully smart person. And she started by building some AI models around voice and video. She realized very quickly how much dollars were going into models and how difficult it was going to be to compete with that. So she moved into what I might call orchestration. So she built workflow tools for corporates. And she said, if I have a difficult time keeping up with all of the changes and foundational models beneath me, they must have a shit show. And her pitch now to corporates is, in a way, I help abstract you from all this chaos beneath you. You can use any of the foundational models to meet your needs. And I'm like an orchestration layer for you managing all of it. Is that a good play? Is that a bad play? Or is that how you think about this market?
It depends on how, I think it's at least a possible play, right? Let's start with that, right? Which is that I'm not sure that simply being able to rotate between models alone at an orchestration level will be enough, right? But I do think that some combination of managing multiple models interchangeably, as you say, and having the surface area around the training of those models, the workflows around that there will be companies that build on top of those models that provide, as you say, an orchestration plus layer, orchestration plus workflow. Like we've looked at a number of, we've looked at a number of companies over the years that are about automating, you know, one of the bizarrely unautomated processes, which is that every business still gets lots of paper. And now they get it online and it's called a PDF. But think of it as a piece of information that's coming to your business that's not kind of input into your system. Right?
So it's usually people call that unstructured data.
Totally. Unstructured data. And every one of them has to have some version of used to be a physical, now it's an online mail room, to get that stuff out, look at it, and key it into their system and get it correctly. We're seeing a number of companies kind of do a combination of, hey, we'll leverage all the foundation models for what they do, but there's a lot of stuff that you can do specialist on top of that to manage that problem. So some part of it is managing the foundation models. Some part of it is adding some of your own models on key extraction points. And then some part of it is just the workflow, where, as you say, and this gets back to your point, if you're, you know, a large corporate, if you're Bank of America, if you're Citibank, if you're Genentech, you want that level of abstraction. You want someone to say, make a lot of this easier. Because I know as...
And deal large, with problems like hallucination and bad models.
I don't want to think about all that
stuff.
Yeah,
like help me with that.
Yeah.
So I'll just tell you like how I've thought about AI, because, you know, probably like you, we started investing in AI-based companies in 2012. It was not a big deal then. It was not really called AI. People called it machine learning, you know, for a while. And it ended up being mostly back office stuff. So I want to give you an example We invest in a company called Revelier. And what Revelier does, and what made me think of it is your example, they take medical records from healthcare providers. Mostly there's PDF documents of people, you know, who have digitally entered something, but not in a structured format. They ingest it all. They use OCR to make it structured and put it in a data model. They run a rules engine against it for the healthcare payers so that they can look at whether the healthcare provision is compliant with the expectation of the payer. So why do I mention this? There's no way these guys are going to compete with OpenAI, but they don't have to. What they're doing is very specific to rules of how healthcare insurance firms work, how healthcare provision works. And it's so specific that I don't think it's like generally abstractable and disruptible. They are growing like a weed right now because what they did is they automated this, Rory. If you look at this process, it's existed forever, but let's call it 30 years ago, it was manual. You sent someone to the office and they pulled files off a shelf. 15 years ago, you got a huge cost improvement by taking those off the shelf, scanning them and sending them to India or the Philippines. So you had labor arbitrage. Then labor arbitrage isn't good enough. So AI arbitrage, machine learning arbitrage, adds the next layer of breakthrough. And again, these guys are growing like weed. Now, Rory, what I think is different since OpenAI came out, and I want to ask you about this, is all of that back-end process automation was already happening prior to OpenAI. What OpenAI, in a way, did is it changed the consumer expectation of how the end user is going to interact with AI. And in doing so, I've been thinking of it more like mobile, because mobile fundamentally changed how users interacted with systems that had to change all systems and use new functionality. And of course, AI is different, but that's how I view what's new. Like, where do you see this?
Again, there's a lot in
there. Sorry, I threw too much at you.
No. There's a lot. I mean, I think OpenAI did two things, first of all. It set a new expectation for interacting with AI and how you do that, as you referenced. And the second thing it did, brutally, is that it took a whole bunch of investment that many companies, including companies you and I had funded over the prior 4 or 5 years, and made it, you know, functionally not obsolete as much as an entirely sunk cost. And, you know, it took things that took $20 million to build and replaced it with something that cost 10 cents a minute or whatever, right? So the I don't want to lose sight of that impact of OpenAI and the foundation models, because that's been a pretty profound one in terms of digesting how to play in this space. But go to your point on the change in expectations and kind of interaction mode. I think the thing it definitely has done is, let's be honest, it's taken AI companies 2 or 3 years ago would kind of hide their light under a bushel. And they'd say to the company, you know, you're selling some vertical software with using AI, and you'd really focus on what it's doing. And then you'd almost be a little bit, not quite ashamed, but you wouldn't mention the AI. The customer's a little suspicious of the AI. So one thing that's really happened here, that's just been an astonishing lift, is there's now this corporate imperative in every company in America to have some kind of AI use case. So you're getting a lift. Everybody's getting a free lift. So, you know, God bless you, Sam, right? Every company is now, instead of hiding their AI, they're kind of talking their AI book. Right. Yep. So I definitely think there's just been raw lift there. I mean, I saw a chart just a few days ago, kind of Fortune 500 references to AI in their earnings calls, and it was kind of flat, 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 and then suddenly exploded. And, you know, it's easy to sneer at that. But I remember, as you say, Mark, the internet in 94, 95, and it was like a light switch. It went from, why would we do this? Why would we do this? This is silly, to, oh my God, we better have a strategy. And the companies that were there just when that happened just experienced this tidal wave. So I think that they're going to get that.
You and I are such big beneficiaries of this right now. Anyone who was fortunate enough to have a company, capital, product, customers prior to OpenAI is suddenly getting a big boom in terms of customer demand. And that's like such a big boom for us.
AI has changed the startup game forever, and companies that are slow to leverage this technology are going to risk falling behind their competitors. If you're not deploying AI inside your startup, and your competitors are, I think we know what's going to happen. They're going to get more done. They're going to move faster. And generative AI is so powerful, but we all know it comes with security risks. There are tons of threats that could cripple your AI investment. So how do you accelerate AI adoption while also managing these risks? Well, Hidden Layer's AI detection and response platform is your secret weapon. It's a security solution designed specifically for AI and large language models. It gives you and your team the tools to see and stop confidential information leaks and to prevent malicious code injection and safeguard your models from theft. It's trusted by leaders in finance, technology, healthcare, and even the U.S. Department of Defense. Hidden Layer helps you generate more by enabling seamless and secure generative AI. So here's the easy call to action. With Hidden Layer, go from pause to possibilities and step into the future of secure AI innovation. Learn how to protect your generative AI today by visiting hiddenlayer.com/twist. That's hiddenlayer.com/twist.
I want to ask you about a term I started using called fomentum, F-A-U-X. Instead of momentum, it's fomentum. And fomentum for me,
yes,
is the artificial sugary high that comes from an artificial sense of customers who are looking to innovate. And so they might buy you and three or four other places because some senior boss in their company said, what are we doing about AI? So all of a sudden, all of the boats are lifting and it's not clear which are going to get canceled in 2 years. Now, as an existing investor, like, of course, we benefit for a while from the sugary high. As an investor looking at a net new deal, how do you make the decision whether to invest? Are you dealing with something that is long-term sustainable or fomentum?
First of all, it's a great issue and it's very top of mind. You know, we're looking at four or five deals right now, and this is exactly the issue because it is terrifying. Because you can just, you know, we've done customer references on deals where, you know, you get off at the end of the office reference and you say to yourself, oh, I get it. The conclusion is that innovation center was told by the CEO, buy something in AI. And right. This is one of only three companies in their specific vertical that made something in AI. So they bought something. Yeah. And they don't have a clue what it's going to do, but by God, they achieved their mission for the year.
Yes.
Right. I love
they,
the fomentum.
They got their
idea.
Bonus for doing AI for the year.
Mission, absolutely. It's in the CEO's report. We're done. So we're really wrestling with this issue. And I think it's fairly straightforward. In the end, you got to believe that people buy things on aggregate that deliver value for them. Right. And you got to believe in some, you know, Kahneman adjusted view of the efficient market, which is that corporate America is pretty damn efficient in the end. If it's really useless, they'll grind it out and they'll figure out in a year or two, right? So you start looking at the tasks and you say, is this automating enough to be worth doing, right? And then we've developed a lot of kind of different kind of checks on that. And it's interesting, we've also done a lot in robotics, which actually very much interestingly helped us here. Because what I like about robotics is the buyers are so non-prone to bullshit. They are industrial guys in the heartland who are like, you know, I can do this with a robot for $80,000 or I can do this with two people for $40,000 each. And I really don't give a rat's ass, which I do, right?
Yeah.
If I can save the money by using the robot, I'm in. And if not, I'm out, right? And we've just developed the belief that you have to have a go-to ROI model that's easy to understand that you can say, here's your savings, here's your cost, here's your non-saving, you know, quality, whatever it is, you know, kind of gravy icing on top. And here's why the economics work for you. And what we found is if the economics don't work, the projects don't stick. And I think it's going to be the same in, you know, white collar work. I think we're prone to more, as you say, because, you know, the white collar people earn more money, they kind of have more juice, they get more degrees of freedom, right? But, you know, we've been looking at a lot of different areas in lawyers, doctors, you know, very consultants, bankers, very highfalutin, white-collar folk, right? And look at the automation tools that are helping them. And I think you're going to need to see fairly task-specific reasons. I mean, I think there's maybe a step back. There'll be two kinds of things. There'll be the clear and obvious ROI where there was a discrete task that had to be done. It was painful. And this new product automated most of it, right? You know, we've looked at deals and we have an unannounced deal in the medical transcription space. I just think it's super clear. Doctors do it. I'd had a prior deal in it, which lost money, but I love the space. And I believe that with kind of foundation models, this is a big bolus of white collar work that can be automated fully and it massively pays off. Then there's a lot of other things where it's half helping the white collar worker in a number of different areas. And we're struggling with understanding how much money you'll get for that, right?
Now, here's an interesting thing to me, Rory, is most people who create startups at the start are deeply passionate product people. They're either engineers, they're product tinkerers, they're innovators. And some of these people come equipped thinking about ROI and economics and labor savings, but some are just thinking about how to build new features and functions and product and innovation and using the latest thing. Like, it's a hard thing in venture because you really want the, I use a restaurant analogy. You want the initial team you're backing to be super passionate about the food, right? And yep. If you're not producing amazing, high quality, differentiated food that's different from what everyone's doing on that same block or street or city or whatever, you're not going to do anything of substance. But then at some point, you need to think about the budget of the customer. Are you in the right city? Are you charging the right price point? Are you good at controlling your costs? And many chefs are not as good at figuring out all that shit. So like, how do you think about that when you're dealing with startup companies?
I think you do have to, you know, be a little Janus-like. You have to look two ways, right? I do believe that you have to look one, because if there is no big vision, if there is no technical big leap, if there is no excitement, you're just not going to have anything. It's, you know, who wants to sell Me Too stuff, right? It just doesn't get any traction, right? But you're right. Then you got to pivot the other way and say, you know, does it work today for the customer? Does it deliver value in such a way as you can predictably sell it and tell that story, right? So I actually think it really is okay for things to have, I mean, the prize is so big for succeeding when it's good. It's really not too big an ask to say you have to be able to hold two thoughts. And it's not quite the F. Scott Fitzgerald of two opposing thoughts in your head at the same time. Yeah. But it's what we say internally, I want big picture trends and near in traction. Right. And that's the stage we invest at. I want to know that there's a big story there. So it's not just a slightly Me Too thing. But at the same time, I want to talk to customers where, as you say, you don't just detect the fomentum. That's a good word.
Fomentum.
What you actually detect is that feeling of, oh my God, I used to have to do this, this, and this. And it was such a pain in the butt. And now the software does it. Oh my God, I love it. That's what you want to see. It's like, so you know, I'll never go back. That's what you want.
This is a good pivot for us, Rory, because you said the stage at which you invest, you talk about wanting to see the big picture, but wanting to see the immediacy of traction. The market seems to have a lot of seed stage, emerging manager, early stage, small bet funds. It seems to have a lot of multi-cycle, we do everything, we raise billions of dollars every cycle funds. It seems to have lots of growth money like sovereign wealth funds who say, can we park 200 million? As I understand it, Scale Ventures sits between that in a way. It doesn't do like the super crazy early bet. Hey, three great founders, let's see what they build. It's waiting at this inflection point where they have that, but they have early signs of traction, and then you make a bet. Is that right? And why do you focus on that part of the market?
First of all, that's exactly correct. And, you know, we've known each other a long time. And, you know, you are doing that early stage. And I don't describe what you do as crazy. I just describe it as it's different, yeah. Right? It's more about the people. It's more about the big trends. It's more about portfolio construction. But yeah. You're exactly right as to where you play, typically around after you kind of, you know, and you know, you can spin it one of two ways. And I'll give you the positive and the negative. The positive version is it's the Goldilocks moment, right? Yeah. You've got, you know, what we say is there's a step function reduction in risk when you go from no revenue to some revenue, and then a linear reduction thereafter. And, you know, if we execute really well, we get in just at that point where there's some revenue. So you can make some kind of an investment decision, right? It's not as clear as a late stage 10 million, you know, a 10 million ARR company where it's at that point, to some extent, just math, but there is something more than what you'd see, right? That's the positive spin. Yep. And to be clear, when we do it wrong, you look back and you go, oh my gosh, you mistook three early customers for traction. And in fact, you're taking seed stage risk and paying A and B prices and you lose money. So you're exactly right. We're just at that stage after which hopefully you're done pivoting and you're starting to scale.
You obviously do it very well. I don't say that just to be nice. I say that because there's evidence. That evidence is Box, DocuSign, ExactTarget, Omniture, some companies you've backed early. The firm has backed people like HubSpot and JFrog and other incredibly successful companies. So I want to give you kudos to that. I think your last fund was like 900 million or something.
Yep.
Like
So
you've got the validation of backing great companies, the validations of people willing to hand you almost $1 billion to deploy, which says a lot. Now, where we sit in 2024, it's fucking competitive. Like, how do you find deals that you can win when you're up against like these massive brands with enormous teams and platforms and all the shit that we have in 2024? What is a, where does scale win? And how do you know, like, this is a company we should chase?
Yeah. So first of all, I agree with what you said, and thank you for the kind words. And I'll also be the first to say, as I say to my LPs, I never forget that we made those very successful investments in a very different time when there was a lot less money chasing things. Both at the time, it was easier because there was less money chasing things. And ex post facto, kind of back to what I said, many of those investments, you know, we did in 2010, 11, 12, and 13, and they compounded merrily for 10 years with nary a recession in sight and with no platform shift, right? So we were extraordinarily lucky and executed competently, right? Rather than brilliantly, right? And at a time when it was possible to make really good money in venture. So as I think about today, I never forget that it's a much less competitive time, which is one dimension, and you mentioned it. And then on top of that, I think it's a more uncertain time. Before I kind of answer the specifics on the question, I just want to acknowledge it's a darn tough time to make money in venture. And it scares the, you know, it keeps me honest every day. I think you have to go into this knowing that this is a treacherous, tough time to make money, right?
But we all thought that in 2011, no one wanted to do venture capital in 2011. It was really hard to raise. It wasn't clear we were sitting in front of this major cycle. So I think it always kind of feels that way. This time it might be true, but it certainly felt that way back then.
I agree. I think that in some respects, yes. One of my rules of thumb is if it's hard to raise money, it's probably going to be easy to make money. But then logically, the converse is true. When it's easy to raise money, it's going to be hard to make money. Right.
Exactly.
And, you know, 2021, 2022, you know, we'd obviously performed, but yes, we had good reception from our LPs, for which we thank them. And we were able to raise money. And many people have raised far bigger funds. And to this day, you know, the wildly successful firms, all of whom, as I remind people, are able to raise $6 billion, like a General Catalyst or an Andreessen Horowitz or a Lightspeed, because they're excellent. And they were excellent. Right.
Yes.
So I don't think it feels quite the same. I think you're right. Back then, it felt scary. But it felt scary and there wasn't a lot of capital. Now it's kind of that tough quadrant, maybe the low quadrant where there's lots of capital, but it still feels scary, which kind of, you know, fills me full of angst, right? So now to your question, how do you make money in that space? Because, you know, that's what you got to do. It's about being very clear about what you do. And we're trying to only do one thing. And you nailed it exactly earlier on what we try and do. That's kind of early in revenue companies looking to scale. We don't want to, you know, deviate massively from that. We've done a few, you know, we're very much enterprise focused. Be good at one thing and stick to the thing you're good at is probably a good rule for right now. Every once in a while when we say, should we try X or Y, I have a partner who says, now tell me why we would want to add more risk right now.
Yeah.
And then you go, yeah, that's a good point. You're right, Andy. And you say, okay, I won't do that. Right. So sticking to the thing you do and doing it well and believing, and then, but you got to check the strategy to make sure you think that's going to keep working, right? I do think it can. I think the next thing then is, I always say that it's about picking. It's about being right. What I tell our LPs is this, if you disaggregate success in venture in terms of the actual return, there's the picking, the number of times you picked a good deal versus a bad deal. And then the return is also driven by the multiple you bought at, the multiple you sold at, and, you know, kind of how the economy was in that period of time. And that second whole bucket of things is outside your control, right? And I think the circumstances in 2011, that turned out in retrospect to be a very favorable set of circumstances. No recession, you bought cheap and you sold dear. Couldn't be better than that, but I can't control that. But what you have to control is the picking. You have to be good at identifying and winning.
Do you come from the school, Rory, of, and there's two ways to think about this, and I know there's people in both camps. Do you believe that picking is what matters the most and you just have to get overpriced and get in the best deals that you feel the highest conviction about? Or does some amount of price discipline matter on the basis that at exit time, most companies who acquire have some rational basis for the price that they will pay? Like, which camp are you in or some other camp?
Interesting. Picking, because there's always a picking. You asked about picking versus pricing.
Well, there's picking, winning, and adding value. Picking is easy. Winning has a component of price to it.
Yeah, that's what I was exactly going to say. So leave adding value out of just a second. Pick. What I would have said is this. I believe in picking over, say, worrying too much about access. I believe that if you could be good, I used to believe and still do, if you can only be good at one thing, it should be picking, right? Yep. And I don't mind picking and winning by being 20% over the other bid, right? And right. I've had that situation. So I look back in some best deals where you won. By definition, you won. You probably paid more than the other guy, right? By 5 or 10%. So you can be wrong by that level and be okay. I think what we saw in 2019 to 21 is being wrong by an order of magnitude is a different thing. Being wrong by 10%, 15%, in many of my best deals, I felt like an idiot for 6 months and then I felt great. But when you're wrong by an order of magnitude, there's nothing you can do. So I think what happened to the idea that, quote, valuation doesn't matter was it was a good insight that was beaten to the point where it no longer applied, right? I think by 2021, a lot of the industry had said there's no price at which you can't afford to get in to some deals. And that will be proven to be utterly wrong. And the proof of it will be there will be lots of great companies where individual investors either get the money back or actually lose money, depending on the terms, right? Yeah. And that's going to be very different than 2000, 2001, right? I think that's fundamentally going to be one of the big picture outcomes of the next 4 to 5 years. And you've talked about this, is where did all these unicorns end up? Is fundamentally people who overpaid for very good companies are going to be taking losses or break evens on it, right? So that's the picking. I want to cover one of the, that's the picking versus valuation. And then you also threw in the second thing, the picking versus winning. And I'll say this. And again, I used to be all that matters is picking. An interesting comment is this. There are so few good companies now, and there's so much money, right? That what's really hard right now is there's a much smaller number of potentially very interesting ideas. And the winning dynamic, we've definitely seen there's many wildly talented firms, wildly talented other VCs. The winning part of the job is something that you probably have to give more attention now than you even did in 2020, 2021, because so much of the market is ex-growth that the stuff that is growth just attracts a swarm. There was a lot in that. So the picking valuation come and then the picking winning come. I'll pause.
Just to put some metrics on it, in 2021, where you say some great companies are going to be built and some people are either going to lose money, even though they backed the right company, or they're going to make their money back by backing a great company, which is not what your job is as an investor. In private markets, people were paying 100 times next 12-month revenue in 2021. The public market comps, which I share all the time, was 24.6 times next 12-month revenue. If you look at 2021, when those two things were true and people were paying 100 times next 12-month revenue, the 20-year average is 6.2 and the 10-year average is 9.6. Do you give any thought at all to comps that you think you're going to face at the time of exit and what a rational comp thing is? Or do you think more, hey, we're writing a $10 or $15 or $20 million check. The market for $4 million or $8 million of revenue pays X. My competition's going to offer that. So, like, how do you think about price?
Sure. Okay. A lot in that again, right? Comps. When someone shows me today's comp as a reason to pay more for something today, I want to beat them on the head until they're a bloody pulp. Because logically, what it says is, you know, in 2021, when everyone's trading at 25, you should have bought all you could at 24. And in 2023, when everything's raising at 6, you should sell, you know, you should sell all you have at 6, right? Yeah. It basically, comps are very, what they're very good at, and it's what investment bankers are very good at, they're very good at telling you what you have to pay now. They're utterly useless at telling you what you should pay now. And those are two very different questions. If you think about a bank, investment banker, every time you hire them, they do a far better job than I can do of telling me exactly what the damn things were today in the market, right? And that's really useful information. If you want to buy the Ferrari today, you need to know what the selling Ferrari is at today. But as investors, what we're trying to figure out is if, you know, metaphor now collapses, if the Ferrari appreciates in value, what is it going to be worth 7 years from now, right?
Yeah.
And what we figured out on that which is a separate question. How do I think about what it's worth 7 years from now? What we figured out is you should roughly assume that the long-term averages apply, provided once you're at the long-term growth rates. In other words, you should look at the deal and go, if it, by the time it settles into a 30% growth rate, if it's a recurring revenue business, it'll trade at 6 to 8, maybe 9 times revenues, depending on profitability. That's your reality. So that's the only thing you can assume on comps. What you really discover when you think about it is the real question becomes, what growth rate can you underwrite on the way to that thing? If you get the growth, look, the insight that was true, that kind of that fatal insight that enabled all the pernicious bullshit was, with enough growth, you can overpay a little, right?
So, but and it so turns the, out- what I'm taking away, and tell me if I'm taking the wrong lesson, is at scale ventures, when you're looking at deals, your biggest question to yourself is, what do we think the 5-year growth rate or the 3-year growth rate of this company is going to be? Because yes. Growth trumps everything if you can hit massive growth.
Totally. And provided you don't, yes, you're absolutely right. That's the first thing you're trying to figure out. What's the trajectory of the company, first thing? Second thing is apply normal valuations at the end, right?
Yeah.
And then going back to, now you know what it's worth today. And now you can take into account what you think you're going to have to pay today. And, you know, you can lean in a little. You can't lean in an order of magnitude. It's just that simple.
I want to give some context that I think you uniquely can provide, having been doing this for 30 years. In the early days of your career, if you took a company public, there were lots of analysts. The analysts covered lots of stocks. They covered emerging companies that could, after they go public, have a nice storied career. There wasn't like quantitative trading. There wasn't like machines like pushing everybody into the S&P 500, meaning you could take a company public. They could be worth $300 million in the public markets and then over time grow to, you know, $8 billion. That's kind of gone right now. And it's incredibly hard to not just go public, but to build interest in your company once you're public. So what I want to ask you is, when you're thinking about markets, are you thinking our exit is still IPO? Therefore, what does it take to build a company like that? Are you thinking M&A is your life? I know you don't think on every deal, but like in aggregate, M&A, the challenge being increasingly regulators are clamping down on the biggest acquisitions and therefore like, you know, can you get a $10 billion M&A deal? Like, you know, just look at Figma and Adobe and that not going through. And then finally, like, we know private equity is stepping in to buy some of these companies as a third thing. But obviously, private equity are much more rational in the valuations because they got to make the return on their investment. How are you think? Are you even thinking about it?
I think you have to. Look, I've read your stuff on this, and I think you're exactly right. It logically is terrifying.
Yeah.
And if you're not terrified, you're an idiot. Right. Used to be two ways of getting, I mean, there used to be two good ways of getting an exit, a strategic M&A or an IPO. And then there was one so-so way of getting an exit, which is sell to private equity for your kind of modest successes that are growing, but, you know, where frankly they needed the kind of hand of private equity to extract value. And you're right. Both of those, the first two kind of ways have really kind of taken a step backwards. It's a lot harder to go public. I don't buy that it's going to take $700 million. I think that's overwrought. But even if it's $300 million, it's still more than it was in 2021, way more than it was in 2000, right? And yes, a huge swath of what goes on in the industry of the value creation is going to be pre-going public. And there's going to be, by definition, therefore, a lot fewer IPOs. Because if 100 companies get to $50 million in revenue, maybe only 70 get to 100, maybe only 50 get to 200, maybe only 30, 20 get to 300, right? Yeah. So a whole bunch of these aren't going to make an IPO, and therefore returns are going to be way more concentrated. So the IPO path fraught, the M&A path is even more fraught, given, you know, what in many cases I think is the absurd position of the regulators and antitrust. Yeah. I mean, you could argue Figma more like what they were trying to stop than most, but some of the other things they're doing, you just go, wow, that's a real hit for innovation, right?
Yep.
So I agree, logically, both the main exits are less likely. And going back to what I said, even when I think about our strategy, probably one of the main things that makes you pause and say, how do you think about that? That is a change in circumstance that gnaws at me and I think will have an impact on my strategy, our scale strategy, and everyone's strategy over the next 5 years. I don't have developed thoughts on it yet. You can imagine a lot more late stage. Go for it.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm right, but and obviously I evolve my thinking as time goes. But I think one of the things that's going to emerge in the next 10 years is if I take the biggest companies out of it, Amazon, Microsoft, Google, Facebook, that are going to have increased scrutiny, whether right or wrong, I'm with you, I think wrong. But if I take that, I think there's another tier down of companies worth $8 billion or $15 billion or $23 billion. Most of the names you don't even know, the end consumer doesn't know. And those companies are going to be acquisitive, but they're not going to buy companies for $3 billion. They're going to buy companies for $600 million. So the playbook in my mind is get in, give companies money, help them raise downstream financing, be a well-financed company, but be very wary of the obscene amounts of money that could theoretically be raised in private markets, because that caps your ability to get to an exit. And it, like, selling for $700 million, everyone can make a lot of money as long as you don't raise too much money.
I think you're right. Look, I think that is definitely one of the solutions, because stepping back, the great thing about capitalism is the system works and the market will figure it out, right? If you think about it, going back to when, you know, after 2001, when IPOs became harder and SOX made it harder to go public, Sarbanes-Oxley regulation, and Fidelity couldn't buy in the public markets, lo and behold, they ended up buying in the private markets, right? You know, money finds a way. That's the great thing about money, right? So, you know, you're exactly right, is that people who are, I mean, there's been a bunch of recent acquisitions, to your point, of, you know, interesting security companies in a $400 to $700 million perspective. Those people, those investors will put up points on the board. If you own 20% of that, you've returned $140 million. If you're a $300 million fund, that's awesome, right? And what it means is that you have to, the more distillation has to take place. You only want to be writing late stage checks in things that can go to distance and get to the public markets. And you're right, there's going to be, but it gets to something you've blogged about, which is there's going to be a lot of stranded assets where it took too much for what's doable. And the next 2 or 3 years are going to be all about people, you know, proceeding through the stages of grief to acceptance and realizing that maybe I do have to sell for 700. And instead of everyone making money, a whole bunch of rounds are going to get a 1X, preference stock is going to be less, and we just have to make do and, you know, get a decent outcome and move on.
The stages of grief, anger, denial, bargaining, depression, acceptance.
Acceptance, whatever. I think that's not quite the order. I think the anger comes earlier, at least it does in me.
But anger's first. Anger,
anger's always
denial,
first.
Yeah, bargaining. You're right. Depression, acceptance. Yeah. And I use this a lot because it doesn't just apply to investors. It also applies to staff. So, like, I always tell people, if you have to part ways from high profile people at your company, and if they were part of your founding journey and you need to ask them to leave, you need to understand that they're going to, like if there's three founders and one of them has to go, this is part of their identity, much like having a child. This is their baby. And if you're going to ask them to go, they're going to go through these stages of grief, and you need to give them time and space to go through that.
Totally. That's obviously a big swerve from what we're talking about 2 minutes ago. But cannot agree more. Look, whenever you have to transition a founder, I actually think being willing to accept that there's a certain amount of therapy, hearing, sympathy, for lack of a better word. And, you know, I always say to people, it doesn't matter if it happens in a slightly inefficient fashion and it takes a month or two longer, so be it. The big picture is
the time is better. It's better because they they need time to get through anger. They're going to be angry at you. They need time to say this isn't happening. They need bargaining. Well, if only I do these three things, could you preserve my role and give me time to prove this? They're going to go through bargaining. Yeah. They're going to go through depression. And when they hit depression, you must be there with empathy, because bad things can happen when people end up in depression. And if what you're doing as a team in asking someone to move on is self-righteous or righteous in so much as it's even good for that individual, they will come to acceptance.
Totally. I agree with that. But I also agree that you have to be willing to let that time happen and be okay with it, because they've earned it. I never forget that, you know, if someone's punching out of a company that's doing $40 million, look, I got my company to $3 million and I totally crapped out.
Yeah.
Getting to 10, getting to 15, getting to 50. These are astonishingly hard.
Great achievement. It drives me fucking nuts. And I say this all the time, like in a meeting with other investors where we start talking about, yeah, they're not doing that well. I'm like, they're doing $200 fucking million dollars in revenue. I never built a company that got to $200 million. At a minimum, acknowledge what they've achieved and show some empathy for that before you talk about how shitty they are.
I did not expect to be on this thread at the end, but could not agree more. And I've seen some of that. Yeah, you just got it. Like, because look, no one on the entrepreneurial side ever said, hey, I love VC as an asset class. You know, the only good thing about us is we're not as bad as the guys you meet when you go public. But I think that's one of the ways you can help. Just honor the journey because it's so darn hard. I mean, and as I always tell people, you know, we're sitting there on the VC side of the table, guys. Going back to what I said earlier, we're well paid, we're diversified, and we're not working as hard as these guys, and our backs are not to the wall. How about we, you be tough on the decision making, but cut them some slack in the execution and show a little sympathy.
Exactly. Cool. Right. So I just have wrap up questions for you now, Rory. Number one, you talked about the overvaluation where people paid obscene prices in 21 and 22, where they're either going to make their money back or maybe lose money on great companies. I want to hear your views for founders. Give them advice on what I might call busted cap tables, where you have some investors who clearly know they overpaid. And as a result, they might do irrational things because they overpaid. I had dinner last night with an entrepreneur where this happened, and she ended up going bankrupt because the top of the cap table just was going nuts and wanted to recap everyone because, you know, it was a good company, but he wasn't going to make his money back. Conversely, you can be in deals where maybe you're the one who overpaid and you watch early stage investors sitting at 4x their return, acting irrationally, trying to force the company to do something that maybe isn't in the best company's or all shareholders' interest. Now, when you get this misalignment, it puts a lot of pressure on founders. They don't always realize it's happening. What advice do you have for founders? And then separately, second question, what advice do you have for funders when they find themselves at odds like this?
Yeah, first of all, on founders, first of all, you're right. Recognize that people vote their book, right? The first thing I tell founders is take out the cap table, run the math, understand where everyone's coming from, right? What's their blended basis, right? And because people are going to do what the comp scheme tells them to do.
Right? Show me your incentives and I'll show you your actions or whatever.
And that includes me. I'm not like getting all virtuous here, right? You got to know where you stand and, you know, what the dynamics are, and not being realistic about that and just assuming that there's some dynamic with people is just silly. So first of all, find it out. And then again, after you've got that, figure out, do they know? Because the first step is you as the founder have to know what's going on. And then how are they going to play it? Like, I have one deal where I overpaid, right? Maybe I have more than one deal I overpaid, but I know the one I'm thinking of. It's a great founder. The company's doing well. And if we grow for another year, we'll grow into our valuation. And after 6-9 months, I told the founder, I just want you to know, I know what's happened here. I've overpaid, right? And if we had to raise today, it would be a down round. And I'm not going to ask you to do unnatural acts. You'd run in a great company. And if you win, if we need to raise in 2 years' time, it'll probably be flat. If we need to raise in a year and a half, it'll be slightly down. So be it. It's okay. I liberate you from having to pretend that it's all fine, right? Because it's great. Once you stop pretending, it's all good. Right.
But no VC other than you is ever going to tell a founder that. I just been around enough VCs. It's why I loved working with you, is that sense of realism and willingness to bring the issue to the founder.
Thank you for that. I think that you're better off being that, though, because it's just quicker. And then one thing to watch, it's interesting, is when you are the anchored money in the cap table, the tendency is, you know, you've paid a ludicrously high price. Again, going back to, don't just look at the cap table, look at their incentives. If I paid $1 billion pre for something, I'm going to make a 1x at $200 million, $400 million,
exactly,
$500 million,
right. $700 million. Exactly right.
I have zero ability. I have zero need to create value. If I'm worth less than $1 billion, let's say I'm worth $300 million today, it comes with $300 million. Right? The next $700 million makes me no money. So I'm against that journey. I am better off selling the company now. But right? There's going to be a lot of late stage investors who entirely rationally from their perspective are going to want to push to sell the company, right? You, again, going back to what I said to start, you as a founder, you don't owe them that. You don't have, you're not maximizing. And frankly, I'll go further than that. You owe all your shareholders a return in equal fiduciary obligation, right? So you have to thank them for their input, duly noted. Sometimes it's, and it's okay, and I totally get that you're saying this, and in part it's your incentives, in part maybe trying to do the right thing, et cetera, right? And then just put it behind and just continue to run the company for all shareholders. Because otherwise,
the real thing, the takeaway for me, for founders, is you must, at a minimum, understand the incentives that exist for each of your founders, because they, for each of your funders, your investors, because they will understand them, including something most founders don't understand, which is called the flat spot. You should Google it if you're a founder. A flat spot exists when you have large liquidation preference, where you have an investor who, between two values, let's say $80 million exit and $150 million exit, makes the exact same amount of money because of your liquidation preference. And here's why you need to understand it, is that investor doesn't make more at 100, at 120, at 130, at 140. So they're optimizing for what I would call a one, not a zero, meaning if you're in an M&A negotiation, they'd much rather sell for 90 because the probability of closing at 90 is higher than closing at 140. So you might be trying to get this up to 120 or 130 to make more money for everyone, and they're pushing you to sell for 90. If you don't understand the flat spot, you don't understand their incentive. But also, Rory, I want to say this as a founder, it's not just enough to know how the financial economics work on your cap table. That's a sine qua non. You must understand that. You also need to understand where the VC is in their career. If you're in the proving stage of your career and you're about to make 1.3x on this deal, you might do unnatural things to keep the valuation high, to show well so you can get your promotion or raise your next fund. And you might be thinking, I'd much rather wait 8 years and have a shot at 2x. If you're Rory O'Driscoll, you're like, 8 years to make a 2x or 1.3, that doesn't matter to me. Like, maybe the right thing for this company and this founder is to sell for 1.3 and be done and move on to his next company. And maybe I will get a back that for being a good ethical player. But anyway, understanding where your VC is at in their journey is also part of the equation.
Totally. 100%. And it can vary, because sometimes the incentives, knowing where they are and then how they're playing it within their firm, because, you know, you're exactly right. There's the don't rock the boat school of, I've overpaid, but as long as no one calls bullshit, this thing can keep, and I can keep, you know, I, as an investor in a big fund, can continue to get paying a very hefty salary for three more years, right?
Yeah.
So it's funny. Sometimes that pushes them one way, and then the other thing that pushes the other way is the, I'm only going to make a 1x no matter what, right? Generally, as a random tip, when the lead dog of a late stage or hedge fund firm comes into view within your cap table, instead of the junior partner you've been dealing with, you're about to have a, please, can you sell this damn company conversation. Right. Yes. Because they don't have to optimize their internal position.
Exactly.
They're just like, I'm a hedge fund dude. I would really like to recycle my $1 billion into convertible debt because apparently it's yielding 17%. And you VCs, I'm done. Give me my money back. Right.
So last question for you, Rory. You've been doing this at least 30 years. You therefore must be at least 45.
Correct.
What advice would you have for your younger self?
Well, I could make a long list of deals that I should have done, but I don't think that's quite what you mean, because obviously venture would be incredibly easy if you could bring that back to you and stuff. You know, I will say I think I'm a bit of a cautious person. I think I was nervous starting out. I think that for a lot of personal reasons in terms of need to make money, I was probably a little more risk averse than I'd be today, right? And I just think, you know, not being stupid, not being crazy, but in venture and in tech, I've just internalized slowly, and I think other people do a far better job of me of getting to that place much earlier, which is that there is no riskless. And given that there is no riskless, embrace the risk, yeah, try and reduce it, but there's no playing safe. It's not the point of the exercise.
And so if you're talking to your younger self or giving advice to people in their 20s today, and you're saying, maybe I played it too conservative, maybe I didn't embrace enough risk, do you think that means in terms of career decisions or things that you did, or like how could we give this advice to young people today? Sure.
I think it's career decisions and investment decisions. Like, the difference between good and great is not obvious for the first year or two because they're compounded roughly the same way, but great compounds over a long period of time and just builds up into so much more. Spend a lot of time thinking about good versus great. Will always be riskier than good. Think about great deals. Think about great people, right? I think, you know, when you look back, the kind of deals that make a difference, the kind of people that make a difference, finding a way to work with those people, to attach to those companies, to be part of big ass upside is the number one thing. And everything, look, everything else to a rounding error, you know, vanishes in the noise of stuff that happened and didn't move.
I want to add to your comment, which is I tell young people all that matters is working with the highest quality people that you can, the most ambitious people that you can, because that's what's going to pay off later in your career.
Totally.
I want to wrap up, Rory, by telling people what I always tell people privately. If you have the opportunity to work with Rory O'Driscoll, if you have the opportunity to work with Scale Venture Partners, the industry is filled with partners who are deal junkies and don't like doing the work. And you will never regret working with ethical people on your board who enjoy doing the work and do it with humor. I enjoyed working with you. I hope we can do it again.
That's the plan. All right. We're still kicking. Take care.
Thanks, Rory.